I think it was when Lagan College, which was one of the first integrated education, there was some polling done at the time, I think it was his 25th anniversary, something like that. And what they did, they talked to students who had been there over the years, and just, it was a voting exercise. I don't think the figures were ever published, but I saw them. They asked children, those who had been there, and the whole idea of the integrated education is to mix Protestants and Roman Catholics together, let them share games, let them share, you know, first communions, get to know each other, a bit of each other's culture, how they play, how they mix, and so on. They asked them how they voted, those who did vote. Now, you would have thought, that should be Alliance hotbed. And if anywhere's going to be an Alliance hotbed, middle of the road, coming together across community, what they found was that around 90% of those who came from a perceived Protestant background, if they were voting for unionist parties, and 90% who came from a perceived Catholic background were voting for nationalist parties. And the Alliance Party was getting more or less what it got, which did not, was 7 to 8%. So even in that situation where the children were educated together and did occasionally go and share first communions with each other, when it came to actually voting, they voted along the old tribal lines, because it goes back to the problem with the agreement and what I said right at the beginning, where you cannot agree on the name of the country, where you cannot agree on the constitutional future of the country, when you cannot agree a programme for government of the country, where you have, as we have with gay blood and gay adoption and gay, you know, abortion, and a minister working his way through 50 Shades of Gay trying to work out which manifestation he hates more. We have him. We have policy directed by a moral compass of one person. And we have John O'Dowd, you know, the education minister, doing everything with his ideological compass. But that's how government runs. And nobody really complains very much. And when it comes to voting again, as they will in 2 years' time, for all of Peter Robinson's let's reach out and hug each other speech, you know, and I know, that 6 months before the next election, he was saying that we need to be careful about the unionist vote splitting here. We need to be careful about Martin McGuinness. And I'll put a bet, well, any of you can make a note, that 6 months before the next election, the next assembly election, Peter Robinson isn't going to be contesting it anyway. But the DUP will slip into the everyday language. It's not going to be Martin McGuinness, you know, as the next Deputy First Minister. It's going to be Gerry Kelly. You know, and he's difficult to work with. And do you really want Gerry Kelly as your First Minister? And all the talk of hope and love and, you know, adopt a Catholic puppy for the weekend and things like that, it ain't going to amount to a hell of shit, because they will still go to their old. And that's, you know, for all those people who believe that this social media, so I say new media, any form of communication will only make a difference if there's very hard, concrete evidence that people want the difference. And, you know, I know it's a gloomy assessment, but again, I stick to my view that my experience of the past 40 years is that most people, if they've not been shot at and they're not having a breakthrough, they can just rub along with each other, smile politely at each other, but just never really have to cross any barriers. They're happy with that. And that's always going to be a problem with your media. And just on point, just very quickly on the lad flag thing, I agree with Alan on that. I think parody's fine. I take the piss out of everyone on my own side, and it's fun, and it's meant to be fun. But I think sometimes you get to the point where you look as though you're turning on people. It's almost become sneering at times that you people are stupid. You know, you people. I mean, let's face it, the reality that I've watched them for 40 years, you don't need a parody site to parody loyalism. It'll do it itself. You know, so if you're going to make fun of them, you need to give them alternative. You need to say, actually, we're not making fun of you because you're stupid or you're bigoted or you're ignorant. We're actually saying you could do this better. You know, if you really are serious about unionism, this is how you get your act together. But that's just a personal thing.
Can I respond to that in a polite way? Well, as warmly as I can. I think, as a young person, we're staring down, I'm going to mix a phrase, down the barrel of a disaster. Peter Robinson has said that we could well see protests again this summer, this Christmas. And we know what's going to happen this summer. I don't think you can be indifferent about that. I think you can be neutral. Someone's got to stand up and say, it's not normal. I like what Newt Emerson recently said, that it seems in Northern Ireland, the greatest sin is to actually criticise the working class. I think what they've done in England and Wales is they seem to have been able to isolate and contain the more fringe lunatic elements of society, like the BNP and EDL, which no one's actually said, but that's what these Bryson types are, and let them speak, let it be heard, we'll have to hear it. But if you see some of the stuff they're saying online, it is scary, and it is not one bit representative of the Northern Ireland that I know and want to live in and want my son to grow up in. So whilst LAD are off the mark in many respects, as I said earlier, unionism's getting down and dirty with the most radical. Yeah, Peter Robinson was at GAA last night, but they're saying, oh, we can't have a cold house for protests. But the way I look at it is, we can't have Northern Ireland be a cold house for the educated, the ambitious. It's almost like a soft bias towards the aspiration that this cult of failure in many societies, and I must balance it by saying I have the greatest sympathy and compassion for a lot of these guys, but they're going down it the wrong way, and whilst it's not ideal, it's not the right form, it's, to me, it's the closest thing that we've got towards someone saying, look, you can't behave like that. And yes, they do need to change their output, and we need more of the same sort of educated middle class.
I'm sure other panelists want to get in, but yeah, we've relatively little time left, so I will open it to the floor. Can I ask people just to give their name and their affiliation, because that helps us, it's useful to know who people are.
Paddy Bowie, so hello to Paul, I'm one of the bloggers on Twitter, please.
Yep.
And I suppose I've just, my supervisor's at the back, Kevin, I just finished the PhD level in this area, I'm in about 3 or 4 weeks ago. And I think there's just 3 points I'd like to make, and I agree with almost everyone's been said in the panel. The first thing is, even myself and Paul met, we might be moving into a time we need to readdress that internet utopian literature of the early part of the 2000s, which saw the blogosphere as something that's going to transform. They transformed the 2004 US presidential election and was central to the Obama and also Alex said, I think Alan will say, just because it works somewhere doesn't mean it's going to work in Northern Ireland, which is just such a peculiar, exclusive thing to look at place. The second thing is, one of the interviews I did was with World by Storm, the Dublin blogger on Cedar Lounge, and he said that one of the problems with blogging is that it's, I think this is a quote, I can't remember what it is, that if you spoke about blogging talk to ordinary people, it's the conversations about it would be esoteric to the point of incomprehension, because it's a largely middle class, educated class pursuit that hasn't really had any real deliberative responses on in Northern Ireland or in the Republic. And certainly if you look at it, we don't have the same kind of cluster of blogs or storm that you get around, you know, the default, yeah, assemblies or the Westminster Village. And the final point is that when I spoke to Owen Vrin from Sinn Féin, I think the political parties don't really see new media as being anything other than an extension of old media. He actually said it doesn't do any more than the big old inky Gestapo machine did. It just does it more quickly, and it means it's more responsive. So we haven't moved into a period where there's a new model for online politics or mobilisation that we do see in some of those movements that are based in not in geographically specific locations, but in the ether within yeah, what we used to call cyberspace.
Mm. I mean, that's kind of interesting because, just quickly, I mean the PUP conference, Progressive Unionist Party, and had their conference last weekend, and it's notable that actually their members, in the sense when they're on Twitter, actually put _PUP at the end of their names. You know, they're actually getting people to represent, to show the label of their party in all their talking, which is kind of a really curious thing, because in Northern Ireland you don't talk about politics, religion, you stick to the weather, you know. So they're actually allowing their nearly, it must be organised, the fact that they're encouraged to actually go and do this and put their label on. And it's very like kind of like Ogre Sinn Féin and so on with the young folk who are very active online and very on message online and talking about stuff, and it's helping parties with their membership, but in a sense that's boring because that's normal, that's what parties are meant to do, encourage the members. Mm-hmm. It's how do you go beyond it. Is it compromise after conflict, is that the Queen's blog?
Yeah,
I mean, it probably deserves a mention in terms of actually getting a whole set of different views together in one place. I mean, the Jimmy Bryson one from last week or whatever, it's remarkably well written and argued and worth a read in a sense to try and understand him. I mean, I think he is a more complex and probably a better thought out character than sometimes he is caricatured, but I think that's probably going to be quite a valuable input into conflict transformation, to at least start to get people in one place. You get Bryson and McGuinness, and you know, within 10 days of each other on one output is pretty good. That's what do we do with it? How do we get it outside of academia, and how do we actually make a difference in society?
When we talk about the idea of the whole sort of utopian dream is this commons. We actually use the phrase the digital commons, homesteading the digital frontier. We don't have any shared space in physical or cyberspace in Northern Ireland. We've got debate, MENA, and I've got Slugger and various other bits and pieces, but really, where is the shared space? In a place that is deliberately shared in itself.
Can I just take another question?
Paul Nolan, Peace Monitoring Report. Just following on from Alan about the compromise after conflict, I mean, I agree, you know, you do get some thoughtful pieces and you do get a little bit of debate, But really, you know, compared to, say, let's go back to 20 years ago, to Fortnite magazine.
Yeah.
You know, Fortnite magazine had some continuity in its own arguments and was genuinely inclusive. I mean, David Trimble was one of the columnists, you know, Adams also. I mean, there was a lot of debate in that. And actually, you know, when you think about, if, as it were, underground forms of communication, and you think of things like, you know, the messages written on cigarette papers which were smuggled out of Oracles from Monkesh, and the dense nature of the debates that went on compared to what happens really on the blogosphere, you don't really get the feeling you're going forward. But I suppose what I wanted to ask really was, you know, a lot of the presentation from the panel was about how new media hasn't transformed the old politics. It hasn't led to the party, you know, there are not people coming out to vote or whatever. But actually, elsewhere, the new politics that's talked about with new media is about the hollowing out of the traditional political parties. It's about single-issue campaigns. I mean, the Obama case is exceptional. I mean, you really, you know, when we talk about this, you really need to talk about global campaign groups like FAS, which mobilise, you know, literally, you know, millions of people. I mean, for the past couple of weeks, my inbox is full of messages because some Greenpeace people have been arrested in Russia. But that kind of politics depends not on people getting off their sofas or their armchairs or moving on their studies. It actually depends on the opposite. It depends upon them actually staying by their computer and working their computer. That's the new politics. And that's what, you know, that's what I haven't seen. That's the dog that hasn't barked at all in Northern Ireland. When I think of some of the attempts at single-issue campaigns, like, for example, where there was the logjam over the selection debate, and the Belfast Telegraph mobilised to kind of make it work, you know, thing to the assembly, make it work. It was pretty terrible. You know, there was a TV image of people marching up the steps of Storm and carrying boxes of handwritten petitions. And I actually can't think of any example of the new politics, i.e., more, if you like, Generation Y, cosmopolitan politics. And I don't expect it to transform Northern Ireland politics. Nobody expects that. But, you know, I would have thought the Generation Y by this stage would have penetrated a little bit further than just one satirical, you know, blog to some kind of campaign where you can actually do it at home. You do it from the Garden Centre, for God's sake. Where is it?
Yeah, I mean, it's the collectivism critique of online action. I mean, Pat, I think you're referring to this too. I mean, the sort of hard wrangled idea of sort of virtual utopia is, in the literature, a lot of it's moved on to talk about the small sort of lifestyle politics that you're referring to, and maybe other panellists have an idea of this. I can't think of one campaign which has had, well, certainly cross-community support, which has been about an issue which was not about the sort of two tribes and these sort of political views, which has had a lot of traction.
I think we've had reactions to things like Constable Roland Kerr's death had a kind of a not on my name hashtag. But I mean, that was really a reaction to it, and it wasn't a campaign. That was more, I can't think of a hashtag in modern days. Really, it's going to have to be a hashtag. Explorers. Is how we're going to know it. It's not Explorers, the aquarium and Portaferry that they're trying to kind of the council into the money for, and it's got information out and people upset about it, but it hasn't changed any decision.
If I can just come in briefly, I think of the Savita Halappanavar case, the abortion case. We have very effective online mobilisation that fed straight into the parliament. You know, pressure was applied very precisely through new media on legislators.
So did that
I think had an effect.
So I mean, the question, the kind of so the why or the how question is, was that online stuff that then was amplified by traditional media that put the pressure on the parties, or what was it that put the pressure? Was it the individual thousands of people commenting on it, or was it three news things at 6 o'clock saying this is shameful?
I would say one thing was the kind of circulation online of suggestions on how people could contact their local representatives.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So the local representatives got these huge numbers. So people were asked to contact their constituency TD directly as a constituent and say, I'm voting in the next election, and I'm. Again, I think it's very common in the United States, obviously.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting, because I don't think we've, in the North, an example of that.
Gail McManus, Queens. I was just wondering, is there any sense that politicians have become scared by Twitter? In the sense that whenever you go on to Twitter on the weekend in particular, what you'll find is that loyalists arguing with loyalists, loyalists arguing with unionists, and you know what we would define, I suppose, broadly as dissidents arguing with Sinn Féin. Is there a sense that those other voices are now starting to get out and are starting to scare politicians, that maybe they are moving too fast for a lot of people within their own communities, and that they've had to join perhaps the flags being part of that as well?
I think this comes back to the whole sort of guidelines thing, and when asking most of the main political parties, what if someone says to you, "I want to go on Twitter," what do you say to them? There isn't really, I mean, Alan, you probably know as much about this as I do. They're a bit sketchy on the actual detail how they do that. I mean, they may give them some websites to look at, how to set up an account. They may tell them, like the PUP have been doing, like branding.
Yeah.
But really, if you're a politician, I think this probably applies not just in Northern Ireland but elsewhere, you are probably expected to use your common sense, not to get engaged, not to say something which goes wildly off message. But as we have seen with Ruth Patterson, for example, that's not always the case. And there is perhaps a lack of support and strong guidance on this for politicians. So there probably is an element of fear in some ways, and some politicians who do perhaps use it seldomly are probably an example of that. There are others, like, I mean, you mentioned Peter Robinson, that it does sound like him when you read the tweets. It's a strange thing.
Very sporadic, though.
There's sort of a tone to it at times where I think when he was having rows with people around January,
yes,
it very much sounded like him, but I don't think that's always the case. A lot of politicians do try to remain as neutral in their language as is possible within the number of characters on Twitter.
But when Robinson gets angry and then
yes,
kind of responds, you can nearly predict that something is going to rile him, and then he goes for it. But it's very, I mean, he stays away from it, despite the fact he's a complete iPad addict, apparently. But he does seem to kind of keep himself away from that. Maybe he knows it's not productive to shout at people online.
In terms of, you know, of the spooky thing, or in terms of getting scared, at the time of the Mays Peace Centre Shrine, whatever phrase they were using at the time, the TUV, UKIP, the Orange Order, and the Ulster Unionist Party organised a petition. And they used the Twitter, you know, to say, you know, oh, we're getting, and they did it over the 12th, and they were going, they're showing this picture of, you know, five or six, it's almost five or six orange men, and just cut off to give you the impression that there was thousands more rolling down the hill, you know, waiting to sign this. And it was always like, you know, this stall was meant to be open for an hour today, it's still open after 9 hours, people still queuing up to sign. And they did this at just about every demonstration across Northern Ireland. They would go up, you know, whether it was Twiddell Avenue or whatever particular avenue they decided was having a protest on that day, they would have a little stall, and again there'd be this shot, and it was quite clear that Robinson was getting spooked by this, because he had this impression that there were tens of thousands of people who were signing this petition. And indeed, the TUV were even saying, we are going to publish this petition, I think, on the first day when the assembly sits, and we are recruiting people to carry it up the steps of Stormont, which is bugger them, because you have to march to half a mile there, they'd be knackered by the time they got there. But that all these people, we have already got 125 volunteers to carry the boxes. And I mean, all of this utter crap, you know, because I mean, I watched one of the stalls, supposedly 9 people. And it was quite clear. And the following day, they went to the demonstration at the Scarver Field, where the same people were lining up to sign the same thing. But it's an example, the only example I can think of, where, and maybe it's something that will be used in the future, where the First Minister, the leader of the DUP, allowed himself to get so spooked that even from, you know, the sunny climes of his luxury pad in Florida, he sent 12 pages, you know, which is probably more pages than they used for the original petition. But he sent, you know, to say, we're calling it to do the U-turn. So it is the one example I can think of. And yet, oddly enough, when I asked the TUV, even off the record, to give me just a ballpark figure, they suddenly became terribly coy. Mm-hmm. And weren't able to give me any figures at all. So I suspect it was a very cleverly organised campaign which all the parties were involved in. But it's the one example we have so far where that Twitter itself was able to.
And Ardoyne in particular, you would think that the Ardoyne residents are very against Sinn Féin because of the type of activity that there is on Twitter. And I just wonder if that does filter down into the parties, or it does again.
And I just, we just have 5 minutes. I actually see 3 hands up. I see 4 hands up. I'm not sure how many. if you can give your questions relatively quickly, we'll maybe take them all together and then ask the panel to say a few words.
Okay, two quick comments. I suppose David Mitchell, University of Ulster, I'm a little concerned by sort of Alex's narrative of despair. You know, like somebody should...
I'm happy sometimes.
I mean, that kind of narrative does maybe encourage this kind of the de-energizing of the good people, the progressive people, maybe encourage them to leave this country and jump ship. There's been all sorts. I mean, there might be new political parties, but obviously the big parties have changed massively. And also, I mean, the fact that they're not voting may be a sense that they're contented as much as despair, that we're turning into a normal democracy where people have better things to do. The other point is, I wondered, you may not have time to respond, but I'm always concerned. I'm not accusing any of the three commentators here of this, but there's a fine line between blogging and commenting and sort of self-promotion, trying to become a brand, trying to get hits to your blog, and stroke your ego. You know, these things are all part of the social media. So I just wondered how they viewed their own, if you viewed your own role. Are you trying to create a more progressive politics, or et cetera, et cetera?
Okay, thank you. Question at the very back. And
hi, my name is Nadine Ashama. I'm a political blogger from Lebanon who just happens to be in town. Unfortunately, I got the timing of the conference wrong. I just came here 10 minutes ago. But I wanted to agree with what the gentleman in the middle was saying, that as much as we are excited about new media and politics and blogging, I think if there's no will on the ground, political politics, you know, will for change on the ground, there isn't much to be done. And I was in Belfast visiting 2 days ago, and I was quite surprised because I thought that there would be more will for change. I got lots of different views on things, and I was quite surprised. And obviously the Egyptian case came to mind, which happened 2 years ago, and I was following up on it in Lebanon, and it's pretty much the same case as you were saying, that there was a will for change, and had that not been the case, nothing would have happened, whether it was blogging, Twitter, Google, or whatever. So in that case, I think that new media provides accountability.
Yeah.
For cases, for example, in Northern Ireland, we're looking at my case in Lebanon, our democracies are a bit fickle, to say the least. So Twitter and the blogging and so on, it can give accountability. But I think for a real change, as again, I'd like to hear you, there has to be the will, there has to be the movement and all the grassroots on the ground in order to be able to channel it so that the new media helps it take place on the ground.
Thank you. Let's take one final one, and Peter, I'm going to cut you out if that's okay.
It's just a quick question on the demographics of social media users. I mean, there's loads of research now forthcoming to show that, for lack of better words, they're angry white men that are blogging and tweeting. And, you know, I'm just wondering about the panel, if you have any ideas as to why that might be, or how we might open it up to a more diverse users.
Okay, so maybe just time for a minute or two from each of the panelists before we wrap up.
At university, unless you do like computer science, it's kind of Microsoft Word and that's it. So maybe there needs to be more literacy, visual literacy, Photoshop, everything, and how to actually do blogs and stuff. So education. Yeah.
I know Alan's blogged on the Ofcom report, so I'll let you go into more detail on that. But I mean, Northern Ireland, there's been a massive increase in internet use. I mean, up until 2010, it was always lagging behind the rest of the UK. Now it's very comparable, and things like tablet ownership and media stacking, it's actually ahead of parts of the UK. So I think in terms of the demographics of it, it's not that lacking in comparison to other parts of the UK, but I think there is still a key point. Political activism online is still a minority interest. I mean, we can talk about Facebook and Twitter. Most people from Northern Ireland who use it don't use it in a really overtly political way, and certainly not to vote or to interact with parties.
Okay. I think, I mean, maybe compromise after conflict should have been called complacency after conflict, because maybe that's one of the conclusions we're coming to, that's we're just, it's over, so we'll just live with what's left. In terms of, I mean, social media, I think, from the point from the back, is a tool, and you can use tools wisely or badly, or not put them back in the drawer and not use them at all. And so I think, in a sense, it doesn't create any change, it's just there to be used like everything else. I think in terms of the demographic who are kind of online doing stuff, kind of promoting stuff,
I mean, I looked up the Facebook stats for Ireland, hoping that I would find that NI21 were about to appeal to a middle class female audience, because that's clearly what they're doing. And actually, no, it's slightly skewed, but it's not. It's pretty balanced in terms of socioeconomic, all the demographics, and slightly more female than male sometimes, but not always. In terms of role, I mean, I think I'm probably doing it at the moment because it's an out of control hobby, but also because there's something about. I would like the process to be more transparent. So, you know, we've been an election observer and talking about what happens to your vote. It's partly about trying to say to people, this is kind of quite interesting. I mean, if you go and put your thing in, you drop your piece of paper in and look, here's what happens to it. And then eventually you get one of these politicians who gets elected. You know, so I'm going about party conferences and things. It's about trying to say, you know, hold people to account with a wider audience and saying, putting this stuff online where it can be found. You will not find a party conference unless you go out of your way to find the hotel it's in, but it's pretty cheap to go online and look it up and listen to it. So I mean, for me, it's about exposing that stuff. Now, it seems to have a kind of an academic thing as well, because you guys can exploit the fact that it's there, but it's primarily really to try and say, here's what there is, make your mind up, do you like it, do you not, at least this is what's representing you, you know?
Well, just on the Council of Despair thing, I've been accused of that before. In terms of what I do, I mean, I work by the Sherlock Holmes maxim that there's nothing so instructive as the observation of trifles, and that's basically what I do. I observe the trifles and I draw conclusions, and as I keep saying, you know, I'm happy on all the conclusions to be proved utterly wrong. I don't agree with you know, this thing about people don't vote because they're happy. I can accept that where you have settled democracy where there's been no real change, but you would have thought, given what's happened in Northern Ireland over the past 40 years, and given the euphoria and enthusiasm and genuine palpable air of excitement there was in 1998-99, you would have thought that would have galvanised people. They would have got out, they would have done something for change. And so it does actually fill me with despair that, you know, they go, I couldn't be bothered. And I suspect they're not voting because they actually think it won't make a damn bit of difference. And that, and in terms of the demographics, you know, and thank you for agreeing with me, the back I always like to be agreed with, but in terms of the demographics, now I don't blog, I don't do, apart from Twitter, which I do just mostly for fun, I think an awful lot of people who, and it is open, you say demographics, blogging, tweeting, it's open to anyone. If you've got a computer or an iPhone, which most people have, it's open to anyone. I suspect there's an awful lot of people who sit down and set up the Twitter account, set up the blog, thinking, I am going to have thousands of people hanging on my every word. And then they realise it's 9 people. You know, usually half of them are family, and the other 3 are completely demented lunatics who just want to vent their spleen at the world in general. And after about 3 months, they just go, nobody's bloody listening. And they just opt out as well. You know, I'm lucky for people like me who do tweet. I mean, people follow me simply because they think they know you through journalism or television. So they don't, again, they don't hang on your every word. But if you're lucky, I'm privileged, I get followed simply because of what I do. But what I've discovered, you know, when you do, and I do troll blogs, not troll them, troll them, yes, I troll them. I troll blogs and accounts. And what I have found, there's some brilliant stuff, and I mean truly brilliant, original thought out there. And the problem is so few people get. And when Brian said, you know, there was a tweet, I think it was a bit you put up about the not British but Brutish.
Yeah.
It was a brilliant piece. And that's why I said, look, this piece itself. And I do find pieces that are worth reading. And what I do hope is that sometimes people will read them. And if a fraction of the people who follow me think that's actually a good piece, then bit by, it's going to be a long process. Mm-hmm. But I just hate the fact that there are so many good people, not just in this country but across the world, who do have thoughts, who do have something to contribute, and they do get drowned out. Some of them just give up because of the abuse they attract. Some of them give up because it's so few followers. And that's maybe the sadness, maybe it's the sadness of citizen democracy, citizen journalism. You know, for all those people who thought it was going to be a liberating experience, it's not, because the big machines, you'll watch the Murdoch empires and the other empires, which they're already doing, they pick off the best bloggers. And within a few years' time, you'll see these new sites, which will just be your blog, put together and say, they'll bring in bloggers who come from different, well, they have different views, but they've the sort of same general outlook, and they will become newspapers of that cyberspace, whatever it is. But it just means that this, what we thought was going to be a great revolution, which would allow, you know, masses, millions around the world to be heard and make a difference, that's not happening. And oddly enough, even though I'm a pessimist and expected it to be like that, it does still sadden me.
Okay, well, you promised us a bleak analysis, and
no, I hope I delivered.
I thought it was an excellent round table. I'm sorry we didn't have more time for questions, but I'd just like to ask you to thank the panelists.
Very good.
Thank you.